Welcome to Disrespect, exploring the stigma around disability, providing information and interviews to entertain and challenge listeners who care about, or care for, or may themselves have become someone with a disability. Monday, November 21st, Ontario's emergency room doctors appealed to the Ombudsman, Andre Marin, about improving emergency room response in Ontario. The problem does not just exist in Ontario, and Disrespect talks to Dr. Douglas Sinclair, who has worked in both adult and children's hospitals, but now Chief of Emergency Medicine at IWK Health Center in Halifax. Dr. Sinclair, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. The IWK Health Center is actually a children's and maternity hospital.
Okay.
I'm an emergency physician who's trained in emergency medicine, really adult medicine. So again, most of my practice has been in a busy adult tertiary care emergency department here in Halifax, which would be comparable to, in Ontario, to emergency departments in Hamilton, Toronto, Kitchener, London, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And again, about 3 years ago, they really needed assistance to run the pediatric emergency department here. As I got involved administratively, then I started to really change my clinical practice over to the department here. And that's when some of the differences became fairly obvious. The specific one, I guess you commented on the National Post, was around waiting times and the fact that overcrowding admitted patients waiting for a bed in the adult hospital is a daily occurrence, and really almost has become, people become blasé about it. Unfortunately, it's become sort of learned helplessness, I would say. Uh-huh. And yet in a pediatric, certainly here, and I can't speak for other pediatric emergency departments, if we had a patient here admitted without a bed, I mean, basically the earth would move until that bed was found for that patient. And I think ageism, it's implicit rather than explicit. I think the problem is that the needs for the elderly population in hospital outstrip the demand, whereas the pediatric hospital is relatively, better resourced per patient. And of course, the numbers of children, at least in Atlantic Canada, are decreasing rather than increasing. And the elderly population really across the country and certainly Atlantic Canada is expanding.
It struck me when I read this comment of yours that this is not a Nova Scotia phenomenon.
Well, that's right. I don't think it is.
There was an article in one of the local papers in Southern Ontario recently about a woman who went in for an appendectomy, and she waited 18 hours. It was at Joseph Brant Hospital in Burlington, and she says that she wouldn't go there again because of the waiting times involved. Yeah. And she was 62. I don't know if that would fall into your category of geriatric admissions, would it?
Well, geriatric usually implies over 65, but I mean, that's just an arbitrary decision.
We've addressed the possibility of ageism. Do you think there are other demographic factors that are, or political factors? Because seniors vote apparently religiously.
That's right. Focusing on the emergency department issues, I mean, that's where my focus really is. And we know that waiting times for people to be seen in emergency is directly proportional to the number of admitted patients who are in the emergency department waiting for inpatient beds. We know that the real waiting occurs in the level 3 patients.
And those are?
And those level 3 patients are patients that we say we'd like them to be seen and assessed, at least the assessment to begin within half an hour, and patients are often waiting longer, much longer than that. And what those patients need, as opposed to the patients with a sore throat or minor trauma, who would be a level 4, those patients usually need a stretcher to lie down on because they may have abdominal pain, headache, vomiting, those types of complaints. So they usually need a stretcher to lie down on because they need to be undressed, they need to be examined, they may need blood tests or other diagnostics. So the rate-limiting step, if you will, for those patients is availability of a stretcher.
Right.
So if, say you have an emergency department that has 25 beds, but half of those beds have patients in them that are waiting for hospital admission, then effectively your emergency department is half the size of what it was before. So the patients that are level 3 patients tend to be in the waiting room because they're actually waiting for a stretcher to become available in your emergency department that was now half the size of what it was before. If you have a sprained ankle or a sore throat, then most emergency departments have another section that you are seen in that have a couple of stretchers, but people can be sit on a bench or a chair. And so what's happening is the lower acuity patients are actually being seen faster because they need a different resource. Because if there's admitted patients in the department, they're seen sooner because they don't need a stretcher.
Gotcha.
Or if they need a stretcher, it's in a different part of the emergency department. So we've got a paradoxical situation here where patients who have intermediate needs aren't actually being seen, are waiting because the admitted patients are in the stretchers that those patients need to be seen. I mean, one of the points that I want to make is that we've identified waiting times as a national issue in this country. We've identified a number of waiting time issues, like waiting for joint replacement, waiting for cardiac surgery or cardiac procedures,
cataracts,
eye care, cataracts, and waiting times for diagnostics, usually around cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should put emergency department waiting times right up there as another one, but that has not been supported
right at
the present time. It's not on the list at all.
Now we'll take a short break with the blues.
Well, it's 8 o'clock, baby, sitting here waiting by the phone. Well, it's 8 o'clock, baby, sitting here waiting by the phone. I'm sitting here praying, praying that you call me back home. Tell me, baby, why'd you have to do me that way? Well, tell me, baby, why'd you have to do me that way? You're gonna pay for that, darling, pay for that somehow, some way. Well, I'm sitting here.
And now, return to our interview.
Has the evolution of outpatient treatment changed the role of emergency departments so that the demands on them have gone up?
Oh, it certainly has, because there are patients now who traditionally would have been admitted to hospital years ago, and now what's happening is they're receiving more diagnostics in the emergency department and often being sent home. The classic case would be someone who had a blood clot in their leg,
yep,
or in their chest.
Okay.
Who a few years ago would have been routinely admitted to the hospital. Now they're receiving all their diagnostics in emergency and are going home to receive blood thinners at home. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's better for patients, better for families. So that's a good thing, but it requires more resources in the emergency department and time. The biggest problem is we have we have limited surge capacity for patients that need to be admitted.
Yeah.
So, you know, every year the flu is blamed, right, for overcrowding. But, of course, it's entirely predictable that you're going to need more beds in February than you do right now. For instance, now, years ago, it used to be said the way to run a hospital if it was efficiently was to have an admission percentage of 85%. In other words, 85% of the beds would be occupied, not 100.
Yep.
So it allows you some flexibility in what we call surge capacity.
Gotcha.
Now, certainly on medical wards, not surgical wards, on medical wards, the bed occupancy is 100% or higher at all times.
Really?
So there's really no flexibility. The other problem is that we've made at least tertiary care hospitals so subspecialized there's no flexibility. In other words, there may be beds, but if you're an undifferentiated patient, so you're a patient that, again, often elderly, but has pneumonia or heart disease, and you know, there may be beds open on a surgical floor, but it's deemed that you can't go there. Some of the subspecialty is important. You got to match the skill setups, but what we've gone too far into subspecialty. So there may be patients in the emergency department admitted on stretchers, and there's paradoxically actually empty beds in the hospital, but, quote, not the right beds for those patients. So
they're assigned, those beds are assigned to departments where the staff or the treatment is so specialized they're not appropriate.
Well, that's what those inpatient units say, but I think that's not actually true. I mean, there needs to be more flexibility. And again, if this was linked as a financial issue, so for instance, in the United Kingdom, they've told hospitals your maximum waiting time for admitted patients will be 4 hours, and that was legislated.
Right.
And guess what? Within a few months, the hospitals were all in compliance.
Oh. So, they
there were financial penalties. But currently, there's no financial penalties to hospitals on these things. Now, again, that's a fairly draconian approach.
But it worked.
But it worked.
Yeah.
Now, people would argue that approach is too simple.
I'm sorry,
This problem is too complicated. But, you know, it worked. And the answer is always give us more resources. But that's not always the answer.
Yeah.
I mean, you could put unlimited amount of funds into healthcare, and you still would have people complaining that there's not enough money.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bottomless pit. There's no question. So you have to have targeted funding, and you have to have reports and, you know, quality management on the funding that's there.
So your experience as an emergency room physician has given you this perspective on what doesn't work, and you've noted that in Britain, financial penalties do work. Have you seen anything else that works?
Well, again, there's a whole bunch of things that need to happen. You need some short-term strategies. So you need the ability to admit patients in a more flexible way within the hospital.
Meaning what?
Meaning to say that, you know what, we're going to, for instance, what they've done in the United States in some ways, to say, you know what, we've got 20 patients in the emergency department admitted. We're going to, rather than have them all in the emergency department, you know what, we're going to put one of them on each floor of the hospital, even in the hallway in the hospital.
Oh.
Because that's safer than having 20 of them in the emergency department.
All right.
And where they've done that in the United States, guess what? Within 45 minutes, that patient, surprisingly, has a bed. So there's things within the hospital you can do. Those are short-term.
Right.
You have to look at medium-term problems. So in other words, who are these patients that have to be admitted? Because when I see them in emergency, I know within 30 seconds they have to be admitted.
Right.
They're usually elderly.
Yep.
They usually have multiple chronic diseases. So
yep.
Diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, often all of the above.
Right.
And it's predictable that those patients will require emergency admissions from time to time. What we don't have is very good chronic disease management to manage those patients so that they have fewer emerge visits. Nurse practitioners or specialist nurses working with primary care physicians intervene for chronic conditions and do a better job. The example that we see is heart failure clinics.
Mm-hmm.
So those are patients who have chronic heart disease. Cardiologists working with usually specialized nursing linking to their family physicians. All kinds of good examples on how they've provided better care. By the time they come to emerge, it's too late, right? They have to be admitted. But
you're talking about ongoing care.
We're ongoing care. You can reduce admission rates and emerge visits on an ongoing basis. Now, in the past, what people have just said, you know what, the family doctor should manage these patients better.
Oh,
but that's easy to say. But the poor family physician doesn't have the resources to do that. I mean, they're in an office somewhere. They get saddled with a complex patient. I mean, that's not going to work very well. So, but they'd love to help if they had more of these assistants. Again, connecting the hospital better to the primary care physician. So those are medium term, and obviously longer term is prevention of disease. But these medium term solutions, I think, would be very helpful. But things that are not helpful that the politicians keep talking about is having more walk-in clinics. And in fact, certainly those patients that now have to wait for many hours and emerge for a sprained ankle or sore throat, yes, they're going to be happier. But you know what? The patients that are waiting for stretchers are still going to be waiting. So again, you could put a lot of resources in to that issue, but it wouldn't help emerge waiting times. In fact, it actually costs more money to have these walk-in clinics than actually an emerge department, because emerge departments are funded on fixed budgets. So if you come in with a sprained ankle, even if you have to wait, it doesn't cost the system really any more money. If you go to a walk-in clinic, they have overhead costs and charges, et cetera. So the whole system is spending more money.
The walk-in clinic bills by procedure,
exactly.
Is that it?
Exactly. Whereas most eMERGE departments now, even in Ontario, are on a fixed budget.
I see.
So what happens is the politicians say, well, we can solve overcrowding in eMERGE by having more alternative for minor illnesses. In fact, that won't solve the problem. It's just going to waste more money.
Right.
So there's things that we absolutely should not do if we're truly interested in solving the problem of waiting times in emergency departments.
Joseph Rent kept a lady waiting 18 hours for an appendectomy. They also shut down their COPD clinic and a number of other clinics as well, as I recall.
Sure. But my parents live in Burlington, and they're in their 80s. You know, if they get sick, they want to go to Joseph Rent.
Yeah. Well, sure, they want to get the treatment there.
Yeah.
The people who are being shafted for whatever complex or subtle reason are still these elderly voters. And it seems somebody sort of dropped the political ball on this one.
I think it's a bit of a sleeping giant.
I'm afraid politicians
will deal with them at their peril, because, my mother's a senior. I am afraid of her. You know, I mean, you're going after people who are well-educated, who have time and resources, and, as you say, who vote in droves.
Yeah.
So it absolutely needs to be addressed. The number one cause of waiting times in emergency departments are admitted patients in the stretchers waiting for a bed. We must address that by having more surge capacity, more flexibility for the patients that arrive, and a medium-term, longer-term solution about managing chronic disease. And I think we have to get it through our heads that finding alternative places to see the minor illnesses is not going to solve our overcrowding problem.
Would not managing these medium-term chronic disease solutions in itself, if it was not followed by funding cuts, would it not create more surge capacity in the sense that fewer people would show up in
emergency
rooms?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Again, to have an impact on those medium-term, we're talking about 2 or 3 years. So it's going to take, you have to ramp up these programs. So that's why I say medium-term. So my point still remains is most emergency departments in this country, why do we allow an 8-year-old with pneumonia to be on a stretcher for 4 days when we wouldn't allow a 4-year-old with pneumonia to be on a stretcher for 4 hours? I mean, that's an awful testament to our system.
Yeah, you've identified this as an emergency room problem, and you've fairly well defined it as amenable to emergency room solutions.
Okay.
Thanks for your time.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
Disrespect has been speaking for 20 weeks or more with Brian Wood in Lindsay, Ontario, in hospital awaiting housing. In the course of those interviews, we've spoken to local housing providers, administrators, and local MPP Laurie Scott. And apparently Brian's perception of the local consensus is one I often hear from angry people, that Brian himself is angry and so not eligible for help. What's Brian's reaction? Stick with us as we talk to him again.
We should welcome you to the show and find out if anything's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any contact from the hospital? You mentioned something about the social worker talking to you.
She approached me last week wanting me to sign a waiver so they could speak to Laurie Scott.
Right.
Laurie Scott, I believe, was looking for an encapsulated version of my situation. I said, well, no, she doesn't really need to know my whole situation, but what she does need to know is the housing shortage for disabled people in the province. It's supportive housing is critical.
Yeah.
At least in this area.
Yeah.
Just, it's not right. I said, I've been looking for months and can't find something even in a private residence.
Yeah.
I mean, I did have that one where the woman took sick so I couldn't move in, but even the John Howard Society has been working at this, so is a social worker here, and The Mental Health Association tried, but there was nothing they could do. Their facilities are not equipped to take me, and I don't fall into their bailiwick of being a mental health patient.
Yeah, I mentioned that to Lori. She's mentioned Community Living, Kawartha Lakes, and Tom Barrett. Apparently, there's a couple of group facilities there.
Oh, really?
But apparently, the hospital has an outplacement manager, right? So they have a job to do, too.
Well, they do have a staff working on it, for sure. I mean, they've been looking around as well, besides this famous list of, infamous list of motels that they come up with.
Okay. Well, if I ever need a motel in Lindsay, I'll know who to call.
Yeah, call the social worker here at the hospital.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, even my doctor had it printed up in big print for me, and I said, well, what did you do that for? I mean, I've already been told about it.
Yeah.
It's not going to do me any good because I can't afford $750 a month just for a room.
Yeah.
And then food on top of that. That's ridiculous. I mean, I've gone as far as 25 minutes north of town here to a small village called Cambrai.
Yeah.
And that really is putting me at risk because I'd be too far from the hospital, number one, and too far from the town.
Yeah.
If I had to come in for anything, for an appointment or shopping or anything. So that was really out of the question.
It's gone.
To Trailer Park just for the winter, and I'd be up there alone, so I'd have no emergency escape plan,
no,
so to speak.
No help if something goes wrong.
Yeah, this is it.
Well, the stock line has become, well, I know it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said that to me. It was a constituency assistant said, I know it's hard. And mm-hmm. I said, don't be ridiculous. I said, it's not hard. It's impossible.
Yeah.
You know?
It is.
Did you solve your oxygen problem?
At this point, it's in limbo because my oxygen levels are getting better, so I don't need it quite as much as it did before, so I'm okay on that. But if it does get worse again, then I qualify it. But my oxygen saturation set levels have to be a certain level before the government funds it anyway.
But people who are on the line, they tend to put them over so that they can get the oxygen.
Yeah, well, they try to, but I'm just at the 91, 92 level, so I'm a couple of points above the line. So
okay.
I mean, if they tried pushing it down, I suppose they probably could, but...
Yeah.
At this point, I'm just holding my own as far as that goes when I go out. I mean, I'm on a pulser mechanism on the oxygen tank, so I only get oxygen when I breathe in through my nose. I get a shot. So I'm just not continuous, so that does conserve it.
Oh.
And then when I'm out in the car with Steve, I don't have it on all the time anyways.
Where do you see the next improvement in your situation?
Not until I get out here in a place to live. In fact, I told my doctor this morning I'm going to pitch a tent in Victoria Park, which is right downtown near City Hall on the weekend, and live there.
Oh.
That'd be across the road from the downtown Tim Hortons and the laundromat, which both have washrooms.
Okay.
Well, I have to run here. You guys have a good evening down there. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
sick and tired, baby, of worrying over you.
At the middle of the show, you heard Rusty Zinn with special guest Kim Wilson on his album Sittin' and Waitin', the title song. And at the end of the show, Big Joe Duskin from Down the Road a Piece, Low Down Dog. Disrespect asks you to send us your suggestions for disability discrimination-related topics for interviews for the show. Please use email so that we can contact you for clarification or so that you can share with us any leads for sources. Our email is radio.stories@gmail.com. Disrespect is exploring a nationwide opinion poll prior to the next election about provincial politicians in support of people with disabilities. If you have a complaint or you have a kudo about a politician, please send it to radio.stories@gmail.com. Disrespect's interviews are digitally edited from live, telephone, or studio interviews.